Make a motion to approve the minutes from the last meeting.
Second.
Okay. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Okay, good. We will move on. I will take, we'll start by taking the resolution to,
Great, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm here tonight to ask your support for 251 proclaiming June 2015 as, I have a hard time pronouncing that, so I'm going to use the initials that I'm used to, HHT, Awareness Month. I probably know more about HHT than most doctors in Ulster County. I've learned the hard way. My daughter was diagnosed with it last year. June 6th, her battle started. She was had to go into the hospital to get blood transfusions. She was severely anemic. For about a year prior to that, she had nosebleeds. We just thought it was, we brought her to several doctors, didn't think nothing of it, and, they brushed it off as growing pains. But when the brought her to the hospital, they had to find out where else she was bleeding, why she was severely anemic. They found out that she had multiple polyps in her colon, which we went through many diagnoses for that, and came to find out she had junior polyposis syndrome, which runs parallel to HHT in certain cases. We had to do and she was in the beginning diagnosed with a different disease where they told us that she had to get her colon removed immediately. So we did a lot of research ourselves and come to find out that we kept coming back to HHT, which is a genetic disease. It's passed down through generations. Her biological mother has it. Her grandmother has it. They haven't been diagnosed yet. But, they have all the symptoms. Her, two of her siblings have it. Two of her uncles have, died from heart failure about 10 years ago. They were just diagnosed as being overweight, and sudden, but, I would assume at this point, knowing what we know, they had HHT and died of, brain aneurysm, which HHT, if I'm jumping all over the place, is causes your capillaries, which connect arteries to the veins, to be weaker than normal, hence the nosebleeds. AVMs, artery-to-vein malfunctions, usually in brain or lungs or heart, which if they erupt, can cause aneurysms and sudden death. Kids as young as 11, 12 have succumbed to that. A few people that their entire adult life have lived with HHT. 90% of HHT victims or patients are undiagnosed for 18 years before they put the puzzle together. We were lucky we put it together in weeks, with the information that was available to us. There is no cure. There is no prevention. There's only awareness. We can save lives by making people aware of it. And that's what we hope to do with this resolution. If I could skip to the companion resolution of 252, we are starting to gain traction in Congress with funding for research, awareness, and hopefully someday a cure. which there's different theories about that. They talk about the possible cure, but other people say your genetic makeup is what it is. You can't change it, so I don't, you know, they might be giving false hope. But anyway, what this program does, H.R. 1849 in Congress, been sponsored by two congressmen. It funds research, early diagnosis, testing, data banks for some $5 million a year for 5 years. And we'd like to see if we can get our local representatives on board for that.
Is this going to be this a one-time thing or every year at the same one?
I don't know if I have the energy to do it every year.
The main thing is to get two to
Tuesday.
Yeah. Right? Yeah. I want to do it every year.
Yeah,
fine. I have no further questions.
All right,
there's no discussion.
All right.
I make a motion on 252.
Second.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I just have a question.
Okay.
So this is in, where is it in?
It's in the House.
It's in the House. What about the Senate?
As of the moment, we don't have any sponsors in the Senate.
Why would
that be? This disease is so rare, 1 in 5,000 Americans have it. It's not diagnosed. You know, we don't have a celebrity or rock star out there. Face.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Mr. Roberts goes to Washington. They got a good look at face.
So this resolution is going to go to all the local representatives. So maybe from there, we can, then that might make more sense.
Do you have any idea, like, it, obviously there's probably different levels of severity of this disease?
Every patient is different.
Is there any type of inkling of how many undiagnosed cases might go on because the symptoms are not that severe? Or?
They progress as you get older, and you know you eventually either succumb to it or get diagnosed. If you do have an AVM in your brain or something, my daughter had to do CAT scans of your organs, brain, lungs, liver, kidneys, make sure everything was fine. Everything turned out normal, but you know the only way to you know, they couldn't be treated, but it's mostly with invasive surgery.
Mm-hmm.
So you have AVM on your brain, you have to do brain surgery to correct it or eliminate it.
Mm-hmm.
Anything else? All
right. All in
favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Thank you all.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All right, we will move on to our next guest tonight, which is Dr. Smith Longley. I guess it's a form of Lyme disease, right? Or is it a tick-borne?
Which one are we talking about?
The tick-borne illness that antibiotic resistant one, I guess it's the one.
Well, there are several tick-borne illnesses.
Okay.
The one that is a viral form, Powassan encephalitis, mm-hmm. is not subject to treatment with antibiotics, but it is a virus. Mm-hmm. Another one is a parasitic, Babesiosis, so it's treated with antiparasitics. types of pharmacology. And the others, ehrlichiosis and anaplasmosis and Lyme, are all treated with antibiotics. They're all different diseases. Two of them are carried by the typical tick that carries Lyme around here, the Exodus campylobacter, and that would be Lyme. Potentially, the others could be carried by that same tick, as can that Lyme virus. So it can, those particular types of ticks that we're used to identifying around here can carry multiple infectious agents. And with a single bite, say one of them, a couple of them, and it, there's no predicting which one it can turn into next. We do have other tick-borne diseases like Rocky Mountain spotted fever that's carried by a different type of tick. And
tick fever,
Colorado tick starry,
tick paralysis.
Right. So there are multiple types of diseases that ticks can transmit. And that's why, we feel, that, again, an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure. I mean, the whole idea of trying to prevent any of these diseases is to, once the tick does attach to you, to remove it as quickly as possible. So really to do those, tick inspections when you come out inside and from having gone out and either gardening or hiking or what have you, and removing that tick, because the sooner that it's removed, the less the likelihood of it transmitting any one of those diseases.
How different are the symptoms or the effect that it has on somebody?
They're very different.
It can be very different, though to some degree some of them can be rather similar in early stages especially. And that's part of the problem, is that some of the early symptoms are what we call non-specific, because, low-grade fever, aches and pains, joint aches, that type of thing can be, a symptom that can occur with a number of them, Lyme included, anaplasmosis, ehrlichiosis, and then it can progress. Like the classic other symptom associated with about 60 to 80% of cases of Lyme is the rash, that bullseye rash. That's rather typical of that particular disease, Lyme. But some of the others can involve some other organ issues, as well as some blood, with red blood cell issues. So you can
get
hematologic issues.
They're all, symptoms can often mimic each other early, but there are often very specific locked patterns. So, for instance, anaplasmosis causes a low white blood cell count, a low platelet count, and elevated liver enzymes. Babesiosis causes a hemolytic anemia. Lyme disease doesn't do either of those. Pyosome virus, typically, if it's going to be severe, causes encephalitis, which is a level of confusion that you really don't see typically with the other diseases. So with experienced clinicians and appropriate laboratory testing, we can generally separate them out very relatively quickly. This year, to give an example, the hospital lab at the Alliance just got certification and training this week to be able to do parasitic blood smear for turnaround in 1 hour to identify babesiosis. So babesia is a disease that was not seen in the Hudson Valley 15 years ago. It was limited to Cape Cod and Fire Island, that area. And it's slowly worked its way across Connecticut and up into the Hudson Valley in small numbers.
What is it?
It's a parasitic infection. It's transmitted by a tick, and it's basically, the best way to describe it is the American version of malaria.
So it gets into the red,
cells and breaks the red blood cells down. It generally is not, it's generally only a life-threatening illness in people who are very compromised or people who don't have a spleen. Otherwise, people generally can be identified, diagnosed, and treated. We've seen, last summer, my group probably saw 10, 15 cases maybe in the Hudson Valley in the hospitals. That my group now covers Vassar and the Hudson Regional and Northern Vassar.
Yes, and then Dr. Patrick is an infectious disease specialist.
So we see these cases.
Wow. So, like with malaria, you never really get rid of it.
You actually can get rid of malaria, and you actually get rid of these diseases.
Okay.
These are completely curable diseases. You just need to
work through them.
The diagnosis is often more challenging than the treatment.
Mm-hmm. Somebody comes in with a tick bite. Do you run all the different tests or the different?
No. It's often a confusing. First, not all tick bites lead to illness. In fact, the vast majority of tick bites are just an annoyance, like a mosquito bite. Most mosquito bites don't lead to bad diseases. Most tick bites don't cause bad disease. In this area, in an epidemic or endemic area where Lyme disease is very common, there are some studies that show if a tick is an ear tick, an engorged ear tick has been on you more than 24 hours, two doxycycline pills as a single dose can likely eliminate your risk of Lyme disease. There are no studies using antibiotics or any other version of prevention for any of those other illnesses. There is no point in ordering lab tests on people just because they have a bit of a tick. We tell them to first get the tick off and be very aware if you develop any symptoms at all of anything, contact your physician immediately. But at the time of the bite, those tests, ordering those tests would be really a waste of time and energy and resources. And then later on, if you develop symptoms, the test should be based, and the treatment should be based on the symptoms, not just a panel of tests for no reason.
Which is how we practice medicine as physicians. You know, there's a whole battery of things out there, but what you have to do is, you know, you listen to the patient, you listen to their history, you listen to their symptoms, you do the exam, and then you work with the most likely
differential, something we call differential diagnosis. And every physician in this country is trained to think in a way. You start with a history, you perform a physical, you come up with a differential diagnosis, a list of the things, potential diagnoses that can fit, and you work your way down the list, and you order and base your testing based on those lists that we go through, and that comes from years and years and years of practicing and thinking and learning and reading and scientific research.
So if you would go to your regular medical doctor, and if you had certain symptoms that you told them about, they would order the proper test?
We would certainly hope they were on the proper test. Some of these patients will show up in emergency rooms or hospitals. Many of the patients with some of these illnesses are sicker than the ones that are going to just go to their regular doctor. Mm-hmm. Someone who's got fever and confusion isn't going to likely show up at their primary care doctor. They're going to show up in an emergency room. Mm-hmm. Most of these patients who have significant illness will show up in a hospital setting, and an infectious disease specialist will be routinely called in to evaluate them. Certainly at the sicker end of that spectrum. People who come in just with a tick bite, a little round rash, the classic case of Lyme disease does not require a specialist or any real sophisticated treatment. It's just simple.
Is there any one specific tick-borne illness that you've seen more so over the past year?
Certainly the trends in the region are changing. So, this is my 19th year here in the Hudson Valley. And early on, it was all Lyme disease, 99% of the Lyme disease. And then we saw Ehrlichia and Anaplasma come into the region, and they certainly have been a significant increase
in those cases of those diseases in the past 10, 15 years. Now we're starting to see that trend with babesiosis come in. We don't know where it'll go, but certainly in the last 5 years we're seeing more of that. Some virus, there's 60 cases in the country, in the entire country, in 10 years. So you're talking about an extremely rare disease that is very difficult to diagnose, requires state laboratory support. It's not something you can just send a test off and...
Can I ask, what are the symptoms of the ones you, I can't even repeat those names. Each one, what are the basic symptoms?
What I've done is, for the convenience of, enough for everyone, unfortunately, but we did, back in my office, put together a little packet of things that we do provide to the public. And on this particular sheet here, you'll see some of the, what the pathogen, how long it takes to develop some of the signs and symptoms with the disease, what kind of testing is done, and treatment. The one here that is still a little bit behind the times and has to be updated is the Powassan one, because at one time we thought the first case of it near state, I think, was a four-year-old or whatever child up in further upstate, and it was a tick bite, but it was a woodchuck tick, it turned out. So we thought that this Ixodes cookii, whatever the woodchuck tick's name is, was the only type of tick that carried the Powassan. And then we found out that it wasn't just the woodchuck tick, but the Ixodes scandularis, which is the deer tick that we kind of are more familiar with. But these are some things. This yellow sheet here, we do have a service at the health department. If people wish, they can bring their tick in, and we can look at it under a microscope and take a shot at the type of tick that it is. It's not going to tell you whether or not a tick is infected with any of these diseases, including Lyme, because not every tick carries Lyme either. But we do give this to the folks who come in, and it's just a daily kind of log sheet where they can record what their symptoms are, and then certainly take the sheet to their primary care doctor, discuss what these symptoms are, the fact that they had a tick bite, et cetera, et cetera. So it's a kind of a patient resource so that they can take it home, look at the symptoms, and then bring it to their doctor should those symptoms develop, and some other informational materials that we get through the state or through the CDC. When they become available, we certainly try to garner as much of those types of things as we can for our public. And unfortunately, you know, over the last few years, you know, we did get a certain stipend from the state DOH at around $10,000 to help support our tick education process, and that has come down the way. So we do not get any additional resources other than some literature and some other things along the way to help support the education process.
Did some of this come from the Miami Chancellor committee we had on Lyme disease, remember, a couple of years ago?
Right. So let's know. We actually, our work with Lyme disease predates that, certainly. I mean, we're doing that. And
well,
we
did anything come out of that?
No, not really. We had the money prior to that, and went away prior to that tick.
I think maybe they came in, I'm not sure, because I haven't been out checking. There was some of the towns were putting signs up.
Oh, yeah. I'm sorry.
But didn't we do also, you did signs at different places?
Was it so?
So is some of this available on your website, Dr. Smith? Like the daily diary, is that something that someone can download?
It will be.
And that other form that you were showing that has...
We're in the process of building and...
Yeah,
I thought
we were adding to it.
We helped And, you know, we are going to post as much of this as we can on that, but it is,
I think there's a thing called motivation being a project. It's all about science. And, you know, the same way we were hearing about hemorrhaging, well, it's your case, it's just a few minutes ago.
Show off, Dr. Sadie.
No, it's hereditary the way we were learning about this, there's science. So, there's people that do their careers and spend their life working in science. And we try to take advantage of that information. One of the studies I often try to put in place is talk about is Westchester Medical Center did a study. That study that generated those two doxycycline pills that can stop Lyme disease if you get bit by a tick. And the way they did that study was that a couple hundred people who were asked if they wanted to participate in research in newspapers if you got bit by a tick and come into their clinic. And they had a tick expert who examined the tick, and the tick had to be on you more than 24 hours, and it had to be a deer tick. And if you qualified for that study, you were either given two real doxycycline pills or two placebo. And you were followed for a period of time to see if the doxycycline worked. The most interesting part of that was what really happened. So the group that got doxycycline, there were no cases of Lyme disease. Zero, which is why we recommend it. But what about the 115, 118 people who got the placebo? So they had no treatment. They had two placebo pills. They had a tick form and a deer tick on them more than 24 hours in Westchester County in the middle of the summer. How many of them do you think got Lyme disease?
5%.
Three cases. So 3.5% roughly, give or take, if you want to, the study significant. Not 90%, not 80%. So not every deer tick, not every tick bite equals a case of Lyme disease or anaplasmosis, ehrlichiosis. We should be aware, we should be preventing, we should be getting those ticks off, doing tick checks. We should be educating our doctors and our community, but we shouldn't be living in panic and fear.
Is there an explanation as to why the increase in all these different types of illness, know where they're coming from? Are they mutating?
I had a great slide. The CDC has a great slide that shows this hill in New Hampshire from a painting from 100 years ago. There's several variations. What you start to see is a town show up. So what's happened is humans are moving into the tick and the deer environment. As we build in wooded areas, that's one of the clear issues. We start pushing and living closer and closer to the deer. There's a reason they're on my front lawn every day. You know, but if they had more woods to run, they wouldn't want to come near us. And then there's just evolution in the way bacteria viruses move and the way the creatures that carry them migrate through the communities. If you remember about 10 years ago, West Nile virus first came to the United States, and it was very much localized in the Northeast. New York was one of the first epidemic areas. And within a matter of 2 or 3 years, it basically crossed the entire country. It just went with the birds and the mosquitoes and vectors. So it really is the habitats of the environment that lead these diseases to move geographically. There's been no mutation. They're not new. They're just finding and moving through different communities as animals are being forced into different environments and as we live closer to them.
And one of the things, too, they think might account for it is, you know, that we did go through a period of time when there were really vast acreages of farmland where a lot of the brush and things were cleared down, the trees were cut down. And, you know, some of the areas that the ticks like to thrive in were kind of, removed in that sense. The geographical layout was different. There's more extensive farmland. Now, as we get residential communities coming back into these have developed farmlands that have gone back to housing, and they want their trees, and they want their, you know, their foliage and all the other kinds of landscaping. They're bringing that kind of environment back closer to where they are, and so they're living again closer. But you can look at the maps that the CDC has and the state does have some of these really interesting color maps, where you can literally see the color of, say, a lime or the beefy or whatever, moving from its concentrated areas down around the Fire Island area and that area, Lyme, Connecticut area, and just kind of moving up the Hudson Valley almost along the river with the, you know, the numbers increasing over the decades, kind of going farther north for reasons that Mark, that Dr. Taxis gave as well. So, you know, it's the movement of the animals, of people changing the way they live and their association and closeness to creatures.
I have a question. Mm-hmm. You know, I've heard a lot of different explanations of descriptions of ticks, like dog ticks. You mentioned gopher tick,
woodchuck.
So,
I think it's true.
Oh, okay. So does that mean that those specific ticks only go for dogs, or for, you know, why do they call them like deer ticks, dog ticks?
Some of that is they have their last names.
Sure.
And, you know, they gotta have a name for it. Well, that's it. You know, American dog tick. And then they get the Latin name here. So they just colloquialism got sort of got attached to the common name was given to the tick. And that's the only reason that some of that kind of designation. You know, there are some ticks which might favor a particular mammal versus another. You know, just through just how they evolve. But, you know, the names themselves are rather just arbitrary.
The reason why I ask is because a couple of weeks ago, I found a tick on myself doing county business. We're on the UND corridor, you know, doing a little back finding. It was on my my hip. But, you know, I did a tick check, and I had my socks pulled over my pants, and and so I'm wondering, do these things, you can carry them on your clothes, they don't necessarily bite you yet, or they can be on your skin and just crawling around, and then one hour, then they decide to develop
again. They look for a particular area that they favor. You know, armpits, groin, behind the ears kind of thing, and the hair lines. But, you know, there is a period of time when they're either on your clothing or still haven't attached formally to your skin and are crawling around. And that's one reason why the CDC and the health authorities, myself, recommend that when you do come in, you know, take your clothes, throw them in the washing machine, take a shower, and this way if there's one that's still just mobile on your person, that you can avoid them really attaching and taking hold.
Yeah, because I figure the longest it probably could have been attached was maybe 6 hours or so, and I put a little petroleum jelly on it before I pulled it out.
Well, okay, you don't even have to do that. You just get a fine solution, just a tweezer.
Uh-huh.
And you get as close to your skin and where their mouth parts meet your skin, and pull straight up. And that'll remove them rather effectively. You don't want to grab it by the this section or put a match to it or put kerosene on them or any of those things that people have done in the past. In fact, you know, you don't want to add too much lubricant because you do want to grab it and grab it close to the mouth part and just pull it straight up. And if the piece of the head and the mouth part stays, you know, when I look at emergency one, a lot of folks come and they have a little black and they always want to get it, you know, remove it. But that little piece is a minor stinger, so that little piece is not going to convey any of these infectious agents that we're talking about. Most of these things live in the gut of the tick, the body part, so it's not necessarily a problem to have that. But a lot of people are fearful of removing a tick, and it's not that complicated.
Can I tell you an interesting, I find this an interesting story. And at first, you know, I think you might tell some people, then they think you're crazy, but this came from very reliable, educated people. And they sent a picture of it on Facebook. This one person found on her father and took a picture of it. You know, a tick, you know, going in, half of it was out, but the head was in, and you could see all the red around it, and he didn't realize he didn't bother him at first. He said that his dog kept barking at him.
I saw that.
Yeah.
The tick was engorged, too.
And it was engorged. He said the dog kept barking at him and made him go back and said, what the heck? And went back, and that's how he found it. Otherwise, he would have never really looked that far back where it was.
Maybe fall off the door, man.
Mm-hmm. I could buy a door.
So there's been some confusion every once in a while. There's been some legislation that's come forward in the last year with Terry Gibson, state senator, and with Dee Barron, I believe, was a co-sponsor, and some Republicans, and then with Congressman Chris Gibson on the federal level. And so I believe the state level legislation is more aimed at trying to get the health insurance companies in the state of New York to cover longer-term treatment than what the standard CDC protocols would be, like 14 to 28 days of 200 milligrams of doxycycline regardless of body weight. And in that regard, there's a lot of evidence overseas that shows, like in the United Kingdom and in other countries, they treat Lyme disease with 300 to 400 milligrams for 3 to 6 months, and the rate of long-term Lyme disease is 5% with that treatment methodology. In the United States, with the treatment of 14 to 28 days of 200 milligrams doxycycline, it's the rate of incidence of long-term Lyme disease is 25 to 30%. And there's films out there under your skin. I don't know if you've seen it. That's going back. There's a sequel now that I missed the other day that was shown in Rhinebeck. But
you're going to very separate, very, very interesting issues. So the first one is the legislation. They're very different. Chris Gibson's legislation is about funding research.
Right.
And that's a very positive step. And I think that's very much what we want to spend money on diseases where few people are involved, because it's important for every person and any of us to be treated. Lyme disease is the most common tick-borne illness in this country, and investigating research is a very good idea. The legislation at the state level was very different. It was about forcing insurance companies to pay for unproven treatments and very expensive treatments that are outside of the guidelines. And it's a very that legislation was opposed by every major medical organization in the country: the American College of Physicians, the American Academy of Pediatrics, the American Academy of Family Practice, the New York State Medical Society, and the Infectious Disease Society of America. Every major organization in this country wrote a letter opposing the legislation. Because if you're going to do that, you don't legislate how we treat breast cancer. You don't legislate how we treat cholesterol. You don't legislate how we treat any other disease process. It's a decision between a doctor and a patient. And insurance coverage is a different, it's a separate issue. If you allow doctors or anybody to decide to use toxic medications without proof, without scientific evidence, there's a problem, and there's a reason those organizations oppose it. Going to the second part of your issue, you're talking about the United Kingdom and dosing and medications of disease. The bacteria that causes Lyme disease in Europe is not the same bacteria that causes Lyme disease in the United States. They're not the same organism. Well, they're in the same family. They're both Borrelias. Well, Coca-Cola and Pepsi are both colas, but they're not the same. And they don't have the same exact impact. So you're comparing, the studies you're talking about, you're comparing apples and oranges. And the studies in the United States that have been done by the National Institute of Health, the NIH, did a long-term study on longer antibiotics in double-blinded placebo-controlled studies and published those in journals and showed that there was no benefit for more and longer antibiotic therapy. Now, I agree with you very much that there's a problem. Patients have symptoms. There is a group of patients who have symptoms that go on beyond the treatment of Lyme disease. The question is not whether they have those symptoms. The question is, do the antibiotics make a difference? And in scientific studies that have been done over and over again by reputable organizations that have no skin in the game other than to publish the data, long-term antibiotics were not helpful. They didn't change the outcome. And worse than that, there are people who died from long-term antibiotics. There are people who have gotten complications from having catheters. The CDC site, their website, shows a beautiful case presentation of a patient who didn't have Lyme disease, but was told by a Lyme doctor they did, had a catheter put in for intravenous antibiotics, developed a systemic fungal infection that went to the heart, and died. Okay, the ultimate bad outcome. So you have to ask yourself a question. There are 7,000 to 8,000 board-certified infectious disease doctors like myself and others who go to school and medical school and residencies and fellowships and do science and read this every day. If there was some other treatment that would help our patients, why wouldn't we give it to them? Why would we hold it back? Oxycycline costs $4 for a 21-day prescription. I use $85,000 treatments for hepatitis C every day. Why would I hold back an antibiotic if I thought it would make my patient better?
So a lot of the, there's like 2,000 strains of Lyme disease in North America and 3,000 worldwide, so there's no crossover between the ones that are in Europe and the ones that are in North America?
There are different strains of Borrelia. The one that causes Lyme disease in the United States is Borrelia burgdorferi.
Right.
The one that causes Lyme disease in Europe is Borrelia sensui.
Okay.
Okay. They're different bacteria. Okay. You would not want me to, if you had breast cancer, but one was one type of cell and one was another, you wouldn't want me to give you the chemotherapy for the wrong one.
Mm-hmm.
Right? They're no different. The antibiotics and antivirals are targeted and studied very, very carefully. The organizations that do these studies, the CDC and the NIH, they have no skin in the game as to how long or why we would treat something. They just do the studies to give you the best answers available by science.
So it's based on your professional opinion, like out of the various, the 3,000 different strains of Lyme disease worldwide, how many of those have the mutating ability, like the difference? So when they go from the, I know you know what I'm referring to, but when it can go from the bifidobacterium to the cyst wall formation in the cell wall membrane.
I guess the answer I would have to is the going to the studies. There has not been a Borrelia bacteria in this country identified in a big lab in the CDC, the State Health Department, or Wadsworth, or any, that have ever developed, mutated, and developed resistance to amoxicillin, cefuroxime, or oxycycline, the antibiotics that we use to treat those infections in strep. The same way group A strep, which causes strep throat, has been treated with penicillin for 50 years, 60 years, and it's still, despite the millions of strep strains, and despite the millions of people who get strep throat, and despite all the antibiotics, penicillin still treats it. There's not been a single documented resistant strain of Lyme disease to those antibiotics in any of the labs in the country. I mean, those are the facts as they are.
What about the work of Dr. Mercola in Long Island that's in the under your skin film?
I won't debate. There's a million people who write and publish whatever they want, and they can say whatever they want, but when you publish it in the New Internal Medicine or in peer-reviewed journals that are recognized throughout the country, they'll get credibility. They don't publish that data in those journals because they have very high standards for what is scientific. And, you know, I can open up the Taste and Lyme Foundation, and I can write that you can smear honey, beeswax, and Starbucks coffee in the skin and it'll treat Lyme disease, and there's some validity to it until somebody proves it otherwise. there's lots of people who treat things different for whatever reason. But you, at the end of the day, if you had, you had cancer, you go to Sloan Kettering for a reason. Because they have the best science. Not because, for no other reason. They have the technology and the ability to do this. The CDC, the NIH, the New York State Health Department, they don't have any political agenda about how long to treat or which medicine is better. They just, their job is just to do the studies, present the data, and educate people.
No, does the body start to build a resistance over long-term antibiotic use to the antibiotic?
The body doesn't develop a resistance. The bacteria in the body develop resistance. So we all have bacteria on our body, and in our colon, and in our sinuses, and in plenty of places in our body. When you take an antibiotic, it gets to some of those places, and it kills those bacteria. The ones that survive are the ones that will not be killed by the antibiotic. So if you keep taking antibiotics, and you keep killing more and more bacterial ones that survive, they'll either learn mechanisms to survive, mutate or learn, or they are inherently resistant to the antibiotic, but you've now given them a competitive advantage in the environment they live in, because you've killed off their competition, and you've changed the natural flora, the natural way the, you know, I used an analogy, if you've seen the movie The Lion King, when the hyenas take over, the natural order of the community is destroyed, and it misfunctions and malfunctions. So the body doesn't become resistant to the bacteria, to the antibiotics, but the bacteria that survive are resistant. And so if you've taken more and more antibiotics, and if you've taken an antibiotic and you come to see me with an infection, I can't give you an antibiotic that's the same as you've already taken. The bacteria that you got sick with, they've already seen that. So I have to use different. And part of my training and my experience, and I do this every single day in my career, probably 20 times a day, I just left Aspen Hospital to come here, is I assess a patient's risk based on what antibiotics they're taking, where they live, where they travel, where they work, what other diseases they have. And that goes into a program known as my brain, and 20 years of clinical training and experience, come up with what's the answer to help you get better, and to pick an antibiotic that should work. And that's what Dr. Smith does. We're all trained in function in that process, that algorithm. And I know that some of the things that you see in these movies and things are scary and nerve-wracking, and they're compelling stories. But they're stories, they're human stories. They're not scientifically proven. And I think you have to go back at the end of the day to that science. Because if there was a treatment, I always said, if somebody could show me a treatment that would make a patient better, why wouldn't I do it? What would be my agenda? I spent all my life trying to make people better. That's what we do. That's what we live for. Why would we hold it back?
Well, I think some of the personal conversations I've had with Chris Gibson about his legislation is that his aim is to get some of these other levels of research that haven't gotten the widespread acclaim in the scholarly journal field, that to get them more recognition is one of the main goals of his legislation.
I think that anything that comes from research,
and then the other thing he and I discussed was they're trying to make improvements so that the Western blot test, which is only 45 to 55% accurate, they can come up with something that's better. Because the best Lyme disease test that you have right now is only 45 to 55% accurate.
Well, in
terms of blood test.
Without, my purpose isn't to debate this science, it's to answer your questions as best I can.
Right.
I don't know that 55-60%, the CDC numbers are somewhat different, they're not 100%. I think that what I will tell you is that there are very few diseases where tests are 100% And but you have to go at some point, you have to go with what you have with you. Well, let me tell you a personal story and then I'll stop. Last year, Memorial Day weekend, I woke up with Memorial Day, that Monday tonight, and I won't forget the rest of my life, with the Bell's palsy.
Okay.
Could not move the left side of my face. I was on call for my group covering 5 hospitals.
Okay.
And I had to work. I called a neurologist, the local neurologist. I said, he was on call here. I said, can you take a look at me? And that day I came to the hospital with him. He said, you got a Bell's palsy. Failed that part. And he put me on prednisone and doxycycline. And because I live on that year all my long. And Lyme disease can be caused by, Bell's palsy can be caused by Lyme disease.
Oh.
So I took doxycycline and prednisone that day, and the next morning I went over to the laboratory and stuck, I didn't go to IGX or any foreign labs. I stuck my hand down, and they stuck a needle and took my blood. They sent off the Lyme tests and the heart a little blood. And my Lyme test came back completely negative. Fully negative. So what did I do? I stopped the antibody. I don't have Lyme disease. I stopped it after 2 days of taking it. 10 to 14 days later, my Bell's palsy was completely gone.
So,
I was kidding. I didn't have Lyme disease. It was not caused by Lyme disease. I had a Bell's palsy. Now, let me play that out a different way, because that really happened. What if, let's play the what if. What if I stayed on the doxycycline? What if I said, the test is wrong. I have Lyme disease. And I stayed on the doxycycline. I got better. But the test is negative. I must have had Lyme disease. I must be in that group that the test is wrong. And I needed one. And now, this year, what happens when my knee hurts? What happens when I get tired? Is that the Lyme disease coming back? The test is wrong. It's negative. I must need more antibiotics. Okay. Where does it end? Where is that in? Every time I get a headache, is it the Lyme disease coming back? Or do I just have a headache? Okay? That's the problem with that reason. That's the danger. And it's real. I lived it. Okay? So I could have taken the doxycycline. And I could be in that spot. But what do you do with the patient that comes in and says, the test is wrong?
Yeah.
What if I was one of those people, those patients? How do I argue with me? Okay? So when a patient comes in and they say, I have a headache, my Lyme disease is fine, and the Western blot is negative, and I know I have Lyme disease, how do you answer that?
Mm-hmm. And give them a placebo if it's not involved.
So without preaching, the answer we use in my group is, we assume that if a patient comes to a doctor, there's something bothering them. There's something wrong. We don't assume the diagnosis is what they tell us. We spend an enormous energy and effort figuring out what's really wrong. Nobody wants to go to a doctor.
Mm-hmm.
And I could sit down with you afterwards at some point, and I could write a book, as Dr. Smith nods her head, of the diagnoses that I've made, real ones, in people who came to me because they thought they had Lyme disease, but they didn't. They have real illnesses. They have real problems. And if I just labeled it, as the Lyme test is wrong and this is it, they go on with their problems. And worse, very dangerous. And worse than that, they go out and tell people, I have Lyme disease, and I got all these antibiotics, and I'm still not better.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And that's how legends propagate.
But there is a flip side of the coin. Everyone in my family, except for one, has had Lyme disease. I've had Lyme disease.
As has my son.
And it does need to be looked at, it does need to be treated, and we do need research.
Absolutely.
And then, like you said, even though I had Lyme disease, in 1994 I contracted something to put me in intensive care for 10 days, and they sent 2 doctors up from Georgia, from the Infectious Disease Center in Georgia, and they sat by my side and never figured out what it was, but I am here today. Unlike, there were 6 people who contracted that in Hudson Valley. 2 out of the 6 died from it. I was very lucky. Resected worked for me.
You know, we have a very good public health system. I would like Dr. Smith all the way through the CDC spend their life working on this. We identify SARS. We identify H1N, bird flu, in a village in China. We can identify a new strain of the virus and shut it down before it breaks through the world. And then there's this assumption that we can't treat our own tick-borne illnesses. These are the same people you trust with your life. Have you been reading much about our famous disease in Africa these days? Why not? Because our government, because it's despite all the public debt that they took, what's really happened? It worked. They contained it. They dealt with it. These people spend their lives doing this. They don't have an agenda to cover things up and hide things. We have a great public health system that takes a lot of hits. And it's a little hard to, sorry if I get defensive here, for Dr. Smith and for everybody else out there, it's a little hard when I hear somebody tell a story and says and all these doctors, all these thousands of doctors don't have a true Lyme disease and don't have a diagnosis. And they're all in debt with the insurance companies and they're all getting checks. I'm still waiting for my check to come. What am I being paid to do here tonight? Zero. Why am I here? To help you, to educate, to work with Dr. Smith. Why Mike called me and said, would you like to be on our board of health? We'd appreciate the service. Why do we do that? What's in it for me? Mm-hmm. The same thing that's in it for you running for the legislature. Why do you do these things? And so when people, it gets a little frustrating because we're on the defense when we're out there trying to do the right thing for every patient. Again, I'm still waiting for the insurance company to send me a check to hold them back every month. I haven't seen them. I've been told that. I've actually had patients tell me. You're in bed with the insurance company. You don't give me these IV antibiotics for 6 months. You're getting paid that. People believe that.
Well, that kind of mentality came from years ago when you had HMOs. And it was a fact that physicians of certain tests, x-rays, they were paid not to order them.
I guess at the end of the day, most of the 99.9% of the doctors that I saw in my life, put on their shoes, go to work, and want to give patients the best possible care they can. And that's their motivation every day.
You have to have confidence in your doctor, right?
If you want to go to those doctors that practice that medicine, go there. Bring your checkbook. It's the only thing I will tell you. Bring your checkbook.
Mr. Chairman, I think we're going into areas that aren't prevalent for the Lyme disease. And I think we should stay on track with that. I've heard everything I need to hear.
So we have basically at this juncture, there's the viral and the bacterial
and
parasite. So there's viral, parasite. Okay. And so now the Lyme disease is bacterial. And so are you seeing the other two increasing significantly?
Polisovirus has now increased to 60 cases in the United States.
Which one's
that? Boston.
The viral one. Okay, you gotta talk English, dude. Okay, it's part of me when I use some of those gloves.
It's called Powassan. I didn't give it its name. So
okay.
It's a hard name to say.
Powassan.
There's only been 60 cases.
And that's the viral one.
That's the viral one. There is no treatment for it.
Yeah, that's not the one that has the
that's people have died from that. It's a bad thing. Mm-hmm. And we really hope that that one does not take off.
Now, you said 60 throughout the country. Mm-hmm. Have any of them been in the Hudson Valley?
The majority of those cases have been in either the northeast region of the country or the Great Lakes region.
That kind
of
sucks.
It follows where the ticks are. Mm-hmm. The great majority of ticks in this country are in the northwest in the Great Lakes.
And northwest or the northeast?
Northeast. Mm-hmm. The northeast and the Great Lakes region. And so that's where the...
We have them all. In our neighborhood.
Yeah. Well, because they like the wet, dark areas, and we have a lot of water.
Woodland.
Yeah, and that's all they like that
long.
They like our skin.
And also made that a like the deforestation type argument where when you start moving into their environment, they start coming out.
What I would tell you is that permethrin, there is something you can get called permethrin. It's a spray. You sell it in different hunting and camping stores. You put on your clothes before you go out. You let it dry. It's very, very effective. 100%. It's very effective.
What is it? It's not. Is it a pesticide or?
It's yes. It's not DEET. It's a different chemical. It is a. It's not a pesticide. It's a. A way. It doesn't kill them.
It's a repellent.
Would be the best way to describe it. It is effective. It can irritate the skin, and that's why you put it on your clothes, not on your skin. It is effective.
What is it?
What's the name?
T-E-R-M-E-T.
I spelled it right.
DEET does work.
It's spelled right.
DEET does work, but you want to be careful. The concentrations of DEET, because certainly it's been shown in young children the high concentration can cause seizures.
Very good. Well, I think that was a lot of information.
Wow,
thank you very much.
Thank you.
Very cool.
I was spraying and oh, you cracking yourself.
Keep the pitch off. We all say this.
I haven't yet found anything that
we're doing. Research is what you do.
Yes, it is. So the more money we can apply for research.
And here's a picture of Dr. Smith. The more money we can apply to our county health budget for prevention.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. That, you know, you want, if anything I could say would be more value, we don't have a budget. The health department does not have a budget for prevention that is adequate for the risk in this community.
Didn't we do something about trying to get money from the state? Not from any of the representatives. And they're all out there talking how terrible this is.
There's a tremendous opportunity to use a little bit of resources
to make
a big impact.
Talk to your...
So you're talking on the hunt level. You're talking about the county or you're talking about in the state, right?
I'm talking about right
here. You're in Elk County.
Right here in
Elk County. So you're making a pitch to these
people.
I grew
appropriation for prevention.
Well, and that's it. It doesn't take a lot of money in order to do some advertising in order to prevention is key, obviously.
And education.
Absolutely.
And that's, you want to invest resources in locally, if you best serve in these kinds of areas, you can make an impact. On your community.
Yeah, I think the funds that could really do a great benefit to every county, you know, it should be from the state and federal government.
There's, you know, I'm not the politician here. I can only tell you that we need federal research and we need state research, but here in our little world, when you just look at that map and we're in the red zone, we don't need to spend our money on coccidiomycosis, a fungal infection that lives in Arizona that causes trouble there. That's for them. Okay? We have our own, and we can use our resources here and make a difference in our community.
Well, Dr. Smith, let me ask you a question then. Do you, every time you do your budget, do you put in funding? Do you put in funding for, why not?
Particularly for preventive work, in other words, you know. Our budget's really based on supporting staff salaries and the fringe benefits and what have you. We don't have a particular line as to that.
But why wouldn't you make a request if it's so important? I mean, how do we know if you're not putting it in your budget?
The legislature knows it's important. You sat on that committee with me.
She does the budget for the health department. So I would make a recommendation to put a line in there for, I don't know how much money you're thinking about, but I would go ahead and put the line in there for awareness, whatever you decide you're going to call it.
Sure. What do you think
is the hearing? And then that leaves it in the hands of the legislature. I mean, the executive could say no, but we know that the line is there, and we could say yes.
That's Pat, you brought it up. You got an objection in mind?
I have not a clue.
You just bring it up.
I just think I sat through those meetings, and a lot of legislators and community members gave up a lot of time, and I think one of the recommendations that came out of me, and the one that I found to be most valuable, was prevention. And we talked about prevention, and so I advocate for prevention, and that's where I come from. So yes.
We can spend a lot of our time on this, obviously, on a daily basis, as part of our routine job duties, really, is that we're doing this all the time. But to have a dedicated line in touch with a particular one, not in touch, but we can certainly.
I would recommend you do that.
I certainly will take that back, that's for sure. but I think one, and I will, but one thing for us to think of on, you know, the federal level and how it works. I mean, when you look at where these diseases were concentrated, I don't think that the representatives from Texas and Arizona and Oklahoma are going to be really all that concerned about that because that's not their population. We really need to focus our efforts on our legislators from our area, the Senate and what have you, and really push them and say, look, this is your catchment area. This is your
I agree with you.
I really agree with that.
Yeah. Well, I, for one, I wasn't on that committee, but I've learned a lot tonight that I never knew before, and prevention would be the key, because...
Well, the committee was a lot in defense of the committee. I think we did accomplish a lot. There were things done.
We certainly had a public forum.
They put out signs. You know, warning people about make sure you're covered, do this, do that. They've done, and then there's a lot you can do that doesn't cost money, which is radio stations and, you know, all kinds of...
PSAs.
Mm-hmm.
Whatever it takes to protect our population, prevention is an old disease.
Absolutely. Well, thank you again.
Thank you very much.
Very good.
Thank you.
Yeah, let's do it now.
Who's not here?
She's not here. Thank you.
No, he's coming. He's got a glass of water in his
hand. Thank you.
We'll move on to resolution 186A.
I'm ready for discussion.
Second. All right. Urging New York State Legislature to amend the public health law. Great to go.
I brought this back to Victoria and to Chris Rucci. Chris did some work on it. I think you and I tweaked it a little more. I think it's something that gives some more changes to it and address some of the concerns that you have.
Vicki should have really included you, so by tonight there would be no issues.
So let's
I have
hits the record?
Yeah, absolutely.
Are you done?
Okay, we moved it.
Oh, yeah. I just have an issue with the first resolve, where it says to correct the aforementioned flaws in the New York Post. You know, that's like, we're stating that we... the first resolve, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, basically, the legislature, by approving this, is telling the state health department that their law is flawed, and I don't think we're qualified to actually say that. How are we qualified to say that that section of health law is flawed? Because I'd like to just say, just the correct Section 18 of the public health law to permit, you know, to strike flaws. I mean, it's inciting and, it's a little redundant, to be honest with you, like I thought, because he first left that in there. And so you could strike, I kind of actually thought that myself when I read through it.
Yeah, to correct the aforementioned New York Public Health Section 18 subdivision and permit qualified persons to correct erroneous patient information. No reason to say flaw.
Oh, right. Yeah. Correct. So strike. So.
The aforementioned. Okay.
To correct the aforementioned clause because it says amend Section 18 within New York Public Health Law that flows together.
I would say to permit qualified persons to correct erroneous patient information without restriction.
Yeah. And to add the word two.
Yes. So you would take out 1, 2, 3, 4, the fifth line of that resolve, where it says take out to correct information flaws within New York Public Health Law, Section 18, Subdivision E. I would take that and take that out, put the word two, to permit also.
Right, because it's redundant twice.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So am I allowed to say that?
Absolutely.
Okay.
Counsel.
Sure. Legislator Allen, at the last meeting, Legislator Belfilio, and I have to concur with him, raised a concern about the supposition that life insurance companies would have access to this information. And I agree with him that there's nothing to prove that companies that issue life insurance policies would have access to the erroneous information, because basically they just do physicals and so on and so forth. So my recommendation, if I can, is to take out the second whereas on page 2 as well as page 4. The fourth whereas on page 2. They both reference the health life insurance policies. The fourth whereas, I'm recommending that because you're specifically talking about minorities, people who are minors.
Right.
And to me, the patient is a patient is a patient.
Okay.
So I would suggest that I could not recommend to my members of my Republican caucus to pass this with those supervisions in there because of what Legislative Bacilio raised. And also, I just think that it's, I know children are just as important, but I think we raise an issue and it involves all patients, and so why pick one out over one another? And then secondly,
you were saying remove the fourth whereas totally?
The second and the fourth one.
I was just looking at specificity, because there is specificity in the law that differentiates between those legalities of people that have access to their own records and people that aren't legally allowed to see their own records yet because they're not old enough. So that's the reason why that I put that in there.
Okay. Well,
so I'm trying to put my lawyer hat on. I'm not quite a lawyer, but...
Well, then you can get yourself in the trouble if you're trying to practice law with us.
No, I didn't say I was going to do that, but I was just,
And then there was one... Maybe
the online one is... I agree with Carl's... I see where Carl's coming from.
And also, let me just suggest this to you, and also in the resolve, it says, and permanently expunge incorrect information from patient file. The term is in the law as well as throughout your resolution, it's records, and this is the only place where you have the term files. So what I would recommend is taking the word files and put in records.
That was Victoria's language.
Well, I don't really, it's not a matter
of... I'm just saying where it came from. That's great.
So just remove files and put in the word records?
Yes.
Okay.
It was the, so I don't have a problem taking that out because it's sort of supposition on the part of the resolution to go into about the detrimental effects. I mean, it's not really crucial to what I'm trying to do with this. You know what I mean? I mean, I have this on the way. Kevin Tangles on legislative aid and Phil Stack's legislative aid. They're both on the insurance committee in the assembly. So this is, you know, I've had communication with their offices about this.
And so, did they approve it?
You know, they're busy men. I haven't heard back from them yet. There was all
reason.
Yeah.
I mean, will those changes, Kevin Lopez, I have no further objections.
Right, yeah, and I agree with that. If you're willing to make those changes, I'd like to make the amendments
that Councilor Guerin suggests.
Okay, going to eliminate all the ones in the whereas the second paragraph, the fourth paragraph, and change the word final and
the
resolve to record.
So you want, let's go over it again, you want.
Well, there's also changes that you also made.
Right.
Okay, so the amendments we're talking about is striking the second whereas on page 2, the fourth whereas also on page 2, striking the language to correct the aforementioned clause within New York Public Health Law Section Subdivision 8,
okay,
and adding the word 2,
yeah.
And then striking the word files and
patient files to records.
Correct. Patient records?
Patient records.
Okay.
So you made a motion,
and you've
been seconded.
I'll second.
Okay. So you have to accept and approve the amendments.
The amendments.
Oh, okay. But you don't have discussion on the amendments?
Okay.
Any discussion on the amendments? No. Okay. And on the amendments?
Aye.
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 Okay.
I have a question. Yes, sir. Do you have potential sponsors for this in the Assembly and the Senate? I mean, it would be nice to at least have something set up in...
That's not the way... I'm sorry, Carl.
You talk with our state representatives all the time. You know, could you get Assemblyman Cahill to carry it in the Assembly?
Yeah.
And Assembly...
I think either Stack or Annabelle.
Yeah.
Stack or Cahill.
It's a question.
I know, but
I'm going to give you the answer. The memorializing resolution, it goes to all the representatives, Republicans and Democrats, and we would hope that they would, one of them, would pick it up and have a second sponsor, and you would hope that it's both houses. That this is a memorializing resolution.
Mm-hmm.
It's not going to carry any weight because it says, Kevin Cahill thinks this is the best thing since sliced bread.
No, it's got to start somewhere. And you want to start with the memorializing resolution from the district that memorialized it.
Right,
I would think.
Well,
I've already strategically, I've spoken to Kevin Cahill personally about it. And he was actually on air with Kingston Community Radio, and I called in and brought it up. And then I spoke to some of his aides on 2 different occasions at critical functions.
Was there anything else?
And he told me, he gave me the name of his legislative aide in Albany, he gave me the phone number, and I emailed it a copy of this, so I could email an amended copy, and then I ran into Phil Stack at a political function in Albany 3.5 weeks ago, and he's on the...
All right, the reason why I'm just bringing this up is because even though it is a memorializing resolution,
every vote that I vote for, every resolution for the last 5 years on this legislature has been, you know, thoroughly thought out. And if I'm going to back something, even if it's a memorializing resolution, I'd like to know whether or not it's got a chance of getting anywhere.
Then
just at the bottom stack of anyone's, you know,
yeah.
I'm going to support it because I think it's a good idea.
but I just was wondering if maybe there was some, you know, interest.
James Stewart, too, I'm going to look for bipartisan support because he's the Senate chairman of the insurance committee. He does represent Northwestern Ulster County.
No matter how hard I try, Carl and I always get in these conversations.
And I enjoy
it. There are resolutions in your packet that don't even, they only have one House supporting them, that Republicans have in that package, and you're going to end up supporting.
That's on the federal level.
It doesn't matter.
Right.
It doesn't matter.
Well, I think
people that represent our district, that when you do memorializing resolutions, for me it's the intent, is to show them that the legislature is concerned about this. Yes, you would hope that then it will, you know, carry some weight.
Okay.
But you have resolutions in here, and we've done it before. They're one house bills. You got one in effect now. It's a one-house bill to say that. It's a one-house bill. And there's another one, too. I asked the question. Who's the sponsor? It's a one-house bill. You're going to pass it.
Let me ask you, consider this. How about, and this is hypothetical, if this committee moves this along to the resolutions this month, how about, I'd like to make a motion that the chairman draft a letter to our representatives and attach it with the memorializing resolution to our representatives, urging them to carry it.
I love that idea. Yeah.
It's a good idea. Then it's a little bit more than just, you know.
I need a second.
I'll second that.
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, it depends on who's writing it. I don't know what.
I'm not going to debate the issue, but I would think that the full support of the legislature would have more weight than...
Yeah, and the personal letter to all the representatives.
Okay.
Not all the representatives, but all the, you know, the personal letter just to all of them.
I think that sounds lovely.
Okay.
This is only voting on. This would be on...
Well, now it's open for a discussion. I think it's redundant.
Yeah.
Because you're going to have a letter from five people, and then you're going to have the full vote on the legislature, which is 23, which would carry more weight if I was a representative. Five people or 23?
Well, they're going to get
23.
If it passes, they're going to get both.
Well, we're going to be part of that 23.
You make a great point about it. It's probably redundant. I think that this resolution, you know, speaks to the point that you're trying to make, and it's ultimately going to the representatives that you want to see it, correct? So I don't know. Well, being there's a motion on the floor for the letter. I agree with Jeanette that it's maybe a little
redundant.
What is hers? How about
All right. Well, on the resolution, then?
It's amended. You had a motion, you had a second?
Mm-hmm.
All right.
I want to thank Councilor Darren for cutting right to the chase and picking out the areas where the amendments were needed.
Chris, you were first. Do you want, should you do that first to move your own resolution?
Sure, I'll move it and
leave
her
a
second.
What he was?
I know, that's what I mean.
It
is what it is.
Okay.
There's nothing to preclude you from moving your own stuff. Mm-hmm. We're just following up on the list. Okay. Ooh. He wrote it and moved it.
There you go.
All right.
Okay.
All right.
Can I make a suggestion?
Absolutely.
Lock 233, 234.
10:35.
All right. So we'll make a motion to block.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All
right.
Discussion.
All right. Discussion.
All in favor?
Aye.
Okay, that's on the block and on the resolution.
Second.
Chris, move it.
I thought you moved it. I moved it.
A substantial amount of money. $250,000 or $300,000. Yeah. And this is an amendment to a previous contract. That foster care is growing tremendously.
That's right.
It's not based on the number of additional placements.
35% county money basically rolls in.
Part of it, but the budget is
100% federal funding on the training. Yeah, but each of the contracts were 35%. The top two were 100% for the United Way and Family.
These are all for foster care.
Those two contracts are not on your agenda. They're before other counties.
These are all for foster care, these two contracts.
And yes, I did read them. So, I know we don't have any representatives from Social Services, but what's going on?
That
long? How about the increased need for foster care?
I don't think we put this around here.
Yeah, no, it's
unfortunate.
I went to an event yesterday having to do, you know, two churches that survived.
One to room dinner, and one here in Kingston, and we have many of them, the Caring has on the 7th Avenue, they serve 150 people a day for lunch.
How much? 100 miles?
150 people a day. And that's only one spot. That is a bed. That's right.
All right, old business is... Garen and I are working on it.
I'm doing some research on this Medicaid waiver program that the state has. And the Medicaid waiver program puts physically and medically challenged adults, places them in apartments so that they can become independent, per se. And been talking to Senator George Amador about the program, because the state actually, it costs the state a lot of money to do this, because you get a patient, let's say, who has a brain injury, and I'm going to make these analogies because this is what I know. But the Northeast Center for Traumatic Brain Injury does this, okay? You get rehabilitated at the Northeast Center, and
through the Medicaid waiver program, the state finds you an apartment and gets you a home health aide and gives you money, you know, for food and whatever. Now, the patients aren't able to work, so they find an apartment at whatever rate, you know, it is, a prevailing rate for an apartment. What happens to these patients is they're kind of isolated now. They were in a group facility. You know, some of them may have been rehabilitated for a year or 2 years, and they're put in an apartment at taxpayers' expense. And from what I can see and what I've discovered, many of the patients return back to the facility and they fail at this attempt at freedom. Independent living. So what I've asked the senator to do is to find out if we can get some funding in Ulster County for a residential area, a residential like apartment complex that has a small medical facility and has home health aides, so that these people can live. They can live independently. You know, they have their own apartment, but they're living in a community environment, which would tend not to fail.
Don't we already have group homes?
Not on the Medicaid waiver program. The Medicaid waiver program puts helps people become independent after either a traumatic brain injury or a traumatic illness or accident. And I think in the beginning when they started that program, I thought, you know, I think their idea was to get people back into society, you know, make them productive if they can, or at least give them a home of their own or a living space on their own. But I think what it's turned into is that they're doomed to fail because they're really being isolated and not actually becoming part of the community. So, I mean, I'll keep you updated on this.
The doctor decides whether...
Yeah, it's a whole process because their treatment is going through Medicaid, and the Medicaid waiver program tries to get them out of the facility and into the community, but you're paying... It depends on the level of disability that people have. They may, you know, pay for a home health care aide, someone to bring food into to the facility, take them to doctors. Usually it's a Medicaid care,
like
the doctor's appointments. I think that the state health department monitors the program because they'll bring them back to the facility where they originated from when they, you know, if they fail. It could save the state a lot of money. It could save the county a lot of money in Medicaid expenses if you had a choice of and I'm not saying a group home. It would be on a facility, whether it be Health Alliance or some other nursing home or at Northeast Center, where they could gradually just go and be independent but live in a community environment. It's at infancy stage. I just wanted to let you know that I was looking into this, and actually, my wife works at the Northeast Center, and she saw a need for this because she works to rehabilitate patients there, traumatic brain injury patients, and she sees them coming back deteriorating after a while, and she sees how much money goes through the system to support them to be independent.
Now, would this community-type facility provide for the medical assistance that they would need, or would it be coming from an outside agency?
It wouldn't be an all-in-one shop type of thing. Like even nursing homes, I mean, they have usually a physician on, you know, staff, but it's not like going to, you're not going to get tests done that you wouldn't get tests done in a hospital and things like that.
They have retirement facilities that provide for the same types of things, like assisted living type facility. So,
exactly.
Something along those lines for people who have, traumatic brain injuries or some other disability that would also prevent them from not working. Now would they be able to work if
well, there's all levels of the program.
Sure.
I'm only showing you the traumatic brain injury side, which is more severe.
Sure.
Sometimes, you know, within a traumatic brain injury, it could not necessarily
blunt trauma, people get traumatic brain injuries from heroin overdoses.
Mm-hmm.
Or the people who survive like a heavy overdose, or brain injury for life.
Is Senator Amador going to do some study on this or something?
Yeah, he's talked to Chairman in the Senate of the Health Committee, and I spoke to him just briefly, and he said that they had some issues. They do recognize that, you know, the way the program is running now, you know, it's basically taking a lot of money, and the results aren't that great. But they're looking into it, that's all.
Good.
But to have a facility like that, that we could get grants.
Or Kingston Hospital, you know, they're looking
for grants to increase this type of quality of living for a patient like that, plus the economic value. Because the Northeast Center for Traumatic Brain Injury is, I think, the only facility like it in the state. People come from all over the state to go there. So when people have family in that facility, they obviously use our restaurants, or stay in hotels, or they even get an apartment themselves if it's going to be a long-term thing. So I think economically, it would be good for this area also.
That hospital would be perfect because it's center.
Yeah.
There's a lot of places they could walk to.
The thing is about the Medicaid waiver program, they don't they place people in apartments.
Yes,
so a room is, you know, nursing home doesn't have apartments. The Medicaid doesn't have apartments.
Uh-huh.
You'd have to build a specialized facility that would have like an apartment.
Well, they could renovate. The hospital is a big place. Kingston Hospital.
Yeah.
It'll be empty eventually. I mean, they're working.
Yeah, I don't know what the
some other things.
Well, that's wrong. Yeah. The idea was twofold. One, to help these patients succeed in their independent living. And two, to stop the siphoning of tax, you know, millions and billions of dollars of taxpayer money to a program that doesn't work. It probably doesn't have a good track record because these people go back into the system and they're back on the regular Medicaid program getting, you know, rehabilitated again and living in these long-term facilities. But I don't have the answers to it all, but
we
started the ball rolling and see what happens.
But you're working on it.
We're working on it.
You're working on all the answers.
What's that?
You're working on getting all the answers.
Oh, yeah. You know, also, you know, when you put something in somebody's head, I also talk to Pete Lopez, even though he doesn't represent my district, or town of Ulster.
But you got to talk to a Democrat,
I'll get him out.
I just
I see them out publicly, so I get their ear whenever I see them. And, you know, sometimes they need a little jolt. And that's when my wife comes in.
Yeah.
And they listen to her.
Well, she, yeah.
They look at me and they're like,
you know why? Because she knows.
That's her expertise.
Exactly. The Democrat would be like, just keep him on that.